Though past 40, Roos was as yet unwrinkled, with scarce a line to tell the passage of time. There was an agelessness about him, a stillness.
Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast.
Originally founded in 2010, as Two Champs and a Chum, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched in the second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and the world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice, comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community.
This is Season 12 of the White Book Podcast. Little crossover for the audience.
Yeah, that's the good old Bolton theory. Roose Bolton being a vampire.
Yeah, I've heard it as the Bolton theory, but I've never stopped to read into it to discover where that name comes from. Because I think Frankenstein when I hear Bolton. So how does that connect to vampires?
I have no idea how that name came about, but the idea is that Bolton might be related to one of the others, or like the magic that made the others, since they share those ice blue eyes. And that over time, this being that is known as Bolton finds a new host and transfers and is thus immortal.
Ah, it bolts on to a new host.
Yes.
Gotcha. Now I get it.
Yeah. Kind of like a warg. And then there's context in the books to reflect that, well, the Boltons have been a family in the North for a long time, and that they've maybe dabbled into some taboo things like warging into people. Mm-hmm. Or, they still, obviously we see in the books with Theon that they still flay people even though they're not supposed to.
Oh yeah. I mean, a lot of things that are technically frowned on by Westerosi society still happen in the books.
Oh yes. Yes. But that's that nice little quote there is a transition to a different game and a different lore.
It is. Do tell.
Well, I should introduce myself as Sam, in case we haven't gotten that far yet. And I'm here with you to go over the new, what are they calling it? Is it an LCG?
No, because FFG expandable, owns that name.
Yes, yeah. It's an expandable card game from Renegade Games, called Vampire the Masquerade Rivals.
Yeah, the new hotness. Or sort of hotness? I don't know. I feel like there was a lot of buzz during the Kickstarter campaign in the fall, which did very well. And then it like suddenly dropped back off of everyone's radar. And yeah. Then now that fulfillment is going out, a lot of folks are jumping back on the bandwagon, so I'm excited and intrigued, but I'm a sucker for any of these expandable card games / LCGs.
Yes, same here.
But It seems like there's a lot of Thrones folks also getting pretty intrigued by this game. There's probably a number of factors for that. But I think we may take a little bit of time to delve into that ourselves and focus on some of our early impressions, some of the pluses and minuses that we see, particularly in that Thrones context. Hint, there's one really big one for Sam and I that we'll get to shortly, and kind of see where it goes. But a caveat, perhaps, for listeners, this is us going in mostly blind. We've read some cards. I think Sam did say he gave in and played a starter game or two earlier today.
I ended up playing a totally different game with a friend where I should have been reading cards. So.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant you played this one. So yeah. So this is totally fresh reactions from us.
That's right.
Okay, cool. I like that. And I'm sure our plan is to come back more after we've gotten some games in under our belts and kind of see where it goes. But this is as brand new as you get.
Yeah. So one aspect of this game that I think is interesting is that there are each player has their decks, but then there's also a board deck called the City Deck. And I think that would be a good place to... we should go over rules briefly first, right? Maybe some talk about that, like what you just said.
Yeah, we definitely wanted to talk about this in a kind of broader scope. So I'm trying to think. I never did come up with like a great plan on how to structure that, so I apologize.
Sure.
So what I might do here is I'm gonna give our listeners a very, very short like outline, like run through the turn sequence type of outline of the rules, and then we can come back and we can kind of pick things apart as we have interest in various pieces of this. Does that sound pretty reasonable?
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. I mean, it's going to be a lot simpler than the Thrones turn was.
Yes. Yeah. Much simpler. So, it's broken down into, effectively three phases in this game. And you do alternate from one player, to the other for full phases, or sorry, for full turns, not step by step.
Not concurrently.
Yeah. So in Vampires, you've got your beginning, your action, and your end phase. So, and like I said, this is just high level. This is not me really super breaking them down, but to start with in the beginning phase, this kind of third entity in the game, the City Deck, reveals a card, kind of an NPC engine, and does its thing. Then you get all your cards, which much like other games, you know, is untapping them, that type of thing. Then you move into your action phase, and you've got a variety of stuff to choose from here that you can do in your action phase. You can draw, you can recruit more vampires, you can play action cards, that type of thing. The catch here is that you get to perform only two at a time, and you can mix and match and do those in whatever order you want. That also includes attacking. And then you've got an end phase where you, you know, kind of clean up, you do some healing, and that type of thing. And the NPC City Deck might, potentially attack you. So that's your super quick, broad look. Maybe two other aspects of that to mention before we start picking other things apart is, that there are 3 to 3.5 maybe ways to attack people in this game, a little bit like Thrones, which I think intrigued some folks. And there are multiple ways to win. In general, you're gaining agenda points, a little bit like getting some power in Thrones, or you can knock out your other rivals, or if some other, like if the game ends without a win condition being fully met, then as long as you're ahead, then you're still actually declared a full winner. So kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So is that a super loose and unproductive bird's eye view here?
I think it's enough detailed enough where, I mean, we don't want to get bogged down by what exactly, how exactly each turn plays out. But yeah, I think you hit the nail. I mean, there's a third entity you take, you know, that at the beginning of both players' turns is going to affect the board, which is kind of reminiscent to me of a plot deck. Though this seems more
variant. I hadn't thought of it that way. See, I kind of equated the plot deck thing to the crypt, I think it's called in this game, since you actually get to construct both your regular draw deck, called a library in this game, and a 7-card crypt of vampires you select. So I thought of that as maybe being more like the Thrones plots.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I thought the vampires as analogous to characters, and just thought it was interesting that you basically always have access to a character. So like Will said, when you're actually sit down to play the deck, each player brings two decks. One is a much smaller deck with 7 cards, and that's just vampires in there, and then a draw deck. And whenever you would draw a card, you can choose from which deck to draw. So it's interesting in that if you need a character, you can certainly go get one anytime that you could draw a card.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. And I'm intrigued by what that says about the focus of the game and kind of the engine to making things happen, right? In Thrones, I guess maybe I'll zoom out a little bit further even to say Magic the Gathering, you know, the 800-pound elephant in the room here. One of the most common complaints there, certainly mine, but also many other players, is some form of mana screw, right? Whether it be flood or screw, like starvation of it, and not drawing the lands you need, so you just don't have income to play stuff, or you only get income, right? And so one of the like key things I think about Thrones is that the plot mechanic tries to smooth that out a lot by giving you some control of that and always kind of giving you an income tool at your disposal. I mean, yeah, there's other factors involved in, you know, the play of specific plots, but income is definitely one of the biggest. So I think it's interesting to me that Rivals takes that same concept, or at least a very similar concept, and instead says that like characters are this thing that we want to make certain you always have available to you, like that we try to streamline that feast or famine effect. And that's interesting where it kind of paints the heart of this game.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it also is reflective in how you win, right? Like I think the first way listed in the book to win is by reaching 13 agenda points. The second is if you knock out your rival and you do so by putting all of their vampires into torpor, or all of their available vampires. So, I mean, when you only start with one in play, it seems like that's pretty important to go grab another one. So mm-hmm. I agree. I think it's very clear what they want the focus of the game to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting to have them available, but like you said, you only start with one. So like it kind of forces, or feels at least from reading the rules, that it would force some pacing on the game, that kind of like some kind of early blitz is tempting to knock out your opponent's vampires quickly while they, you know, have very few or possibly one, but that's a double-sided sword if they're able to swing back at you. because you're also potentially in that same boat. So maybe it forces games to have a bit more of a progression. I don't know. I admit, as far as now that I'm on to progression and thinking about income in Thrones, I am a little worried that it looks like Vampyre maybe may have some of the same issues with progression or lack thereof, right? Like Magic, Hearthstone, whatever, you have this steadily increasing amount of resources available to you, which means you're not, you know, playing your haymaker on turn one.
Sure.
But you could in this game, or at least you could come much closer to it than those type of games.
Yeah, maybe. I think I would have to play a couple of games to really have a good idea of how to respond to that. Like, I think, part of the other thing is it seems, or in Vampyre, you start with all of your income. And then there are cards, of course, that will generate prestige, which is equivalent to gold. But you basically start with most of the prestige you're going to have for the game.
Yeah.
So I think that's also interesting where, like, sure, you can spend that all right away, but also keeping in mind that one of the ways you lose is by running or is by becoming bankrupt.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe that does help kind of pump some brakes. Or at least it definitely causes some thought in the late game.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the rules make for an interesting game that I'm excited to try.
Yeah.
And it scales from 2 to 4 players, so I think it was clearly it had a focus on multiplayer, like 4-player in its development. So I think that's also interesting in that it differs kind of from Thrones, especially second edition, which maybe was designed more with Joust in mind and then Melee as a second or third afterthought.
In the core set, at least for Thrones, Melee was definitely thought about, but it got dropped more and more as time went on, I feel.
It'd be interesting to see how this game handles that.
Yeah, I think you're totally right that this will be interesting, and that is definitely a big draw for me. We can get into some of the uniqueness of that and how that works, but maybe now that I'm thinking about it, since you were wanting to talk about the city deck, let's work our way through those three main phases and talk about what we find interesting about those or you know, what we have problems with or what, you know, whatever our thoughts may be on those. Since the city deck kind of does its thing there at the start of each turn, right? And it's each player's turn, so it gets to do something. So that's interesting.
I feel like at the beginning of the game, you flip over a couple of cards in the city deck. And then every turn you flip over one new one, and events last for about a turn for each player. And then there are characters that come from the city deck that actually move to the streets, and that's where you get this conflict. So the streets are where most of the fighting happens in this game.
Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of a generic, like, battlefield type of zone, as far as I understand it, right? It's just one generic area that says this is the streets. If your vampires aren't there, they're at your haven. Is that what it's called? Your, like, home base?
Yep, right. So the streets is actually reminiscent to me of and this is going to show how I just play a lot of card games, but the Naruto card game, the CCG from 2006, you build parties and send them to the village or send them off to attack the opposing village. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's kind of what this is here, which I looked up the designer for this game and it makes sense. He actually designed in 2014, the successor to the Naruto CCG. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, right. I was like, oh, yeah, okay, this is why this is familiar. But.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and I think it also has some shades of stuff like L5R, where your folks are either at home or you're putting them together to go attack provinces and things like that.
So is there any, like, do you want to get into cards or how do you want to move forward?
Well, one thing, just broad scope of the city deck that I find interesting that I'm thinking about is, one, you mentioned, I think right before we started recording, that this is one of the things that almost makes it feel more board game like to you. Which got me to thinking, like, this kind of third entity, right? It's almost like having another player or something, which made me think of the co-op LCGs or other card games, like Sentinels of the Multiverse, not technically a LCG or equivalent, but still a co-op card game, or even Lord of the Rings or Arkham, that type of thing. So I sort of feel like it has shades of that kind of paper AI antagonist, which I think is interesting and gives them some space to explore later on, to really play with that co-op idea if they want to, or, you know, some kind of raid deck type of big bad type thing like the old WoW CCG used to do.
Sure.
But then I also thought, oh shoot, for a game that is designed heavily with multiplayer in mind, it just kind of clicked for me that the city deck is kind of how you can help make a multiplayer focused game still function mostly correctly in 1v1.
You create
a fake third player, basically.
Yeah.
And like suddenly then it all clicked. Because at first I thought it seemed very strange to have this extra city deck until you sent me down that board game train of thought. And that's when it clicked for me. This is your third player for one-on-one.
Yeah, it also, it does propel things forward too, in that, like, in the same traps that you could get in, like, in Thrones Melee, where, you know, if people go in as a team, they can essentially king make. I don't know that the city deck allows for that as much when the city deck itself is throwing out threats. And there's just a lot of interaction from the city deck itself that isn't is somewhat unpredictable. And so I think you're right in that, like, it's essentially when you play with just two people, there's essentially a third player that doesn't have any stake in either player's game. So
yeah,
it's interesting.
Yeah. I like that. And you mentioned about the unpredictable. A feature of it is that you don't utilize the whole thing that came in the box here in every game.
You
burn some of the events before the game and you play with a smaller deck, which is one of the weird quirks of these rules that I wanted to mention. Why do you play with a 23-card city deck? It just hurts my brain. I mean, you could sort of ask that same question about any number, right? Why do you play with a 7-card plot deck or whatever? But like 23 has no significance like a number like 13 does for the number of agenda points, right? It's got that unlucky connotation, that kind of doom and gloom that fits with, you know, vampire. 23 is just this awkward, odd prime number that just like hurts my brain. Why isn't it 20 cards or 25 cards? Even 22 or 24 would be slightly better.
Are you going to go Jim Carrey on us?
Oh, I'm inches away from it. something about that. I just don't know how you wind up at that point. It just feels like weird, dumb luck yeah, that I mean, you would normally stray from.
When you're making the rules to your own Calvin ball, 23 is a good number.
I guess, but it's also like, I mean, I could make a game where you need 17 and one half agenda points to win the game.
Yeah,
but
that's like, strange.
Why would I? Like, I need to have a good reason to break those kind of mental shortcuts that make it easier for people to keep up with a game like this and like process it.
So consider if you have four people at the table and at the beginning of every player's turn, they flip over one of these cards. It maybe is its own like a little timer so that each player gets four or eight turns. But the city deck, right. Once city deck
well,
is
but
empty,
eight times
not
four
like,
would be 24 though.
Right. That's yeah. So I mean, oh shoot. Yeah. And then the first player is going to flip over three.
Yeah.
First turn. So then you end up with 20. So then you have five turns after that.
Okay,
but
so maybe
the game
maybe
doesn't end. The game doesn't end when the city deck is empty. So yeah, it's just kind of strange.
Yeah. Like I don't know. I'm not saying there's not a reason for it. I just like want to ask the designer, what is the reason for it?
Yeah, it's an interesting question.
Yeah, I get wrapped up in little things. Oh well. Okay. The rest of the beginning phase I feel is pretty straightforward. Oh, sorry. You had mentioned specific cards. Were there some specific ones from the city deck that you were wanting to kind of mention here?
Well, I think it's worth noting, the city deck has, antagonists in them, that will affect both players. So there's some incentive to fight the city deck.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and some incentive, like you can get agenda points for beating them, right?
Right. So yeah, you get agenda points for beating them. And then like there are various things that will make it so that if you defeat things from the city deck, you gain agenda. Or if you defeat, like they'll make it. So if you defeat an opponent's thing, then you'll get an agenda. So there's more, incentives for you to like interact with each other. So like, one of the cards I'm looking at is City on the Brink, which is an event and it's ongoing. So when you flip this one from the city deck, you put a prestige token on it of your color from the general supply just to note who was the one to flip it. So that then the next time you'd flip a card, you actually burn this one. So it's now that one's no longer active.
Mm-hmm.
But City on the Brink is an event, it's ongoing, and when you defeat a foe's character, you gain one agenda, or gain one agenda point. So that's one to me that's like, there. It's going to incentivize you to attack your opponent. Mm-hmm. So these are ways where I think it's just interesting how this city deck can kind of throw your game plan off a little bit. And then these are active for both players. And since you don't burn it until the start of your next round, you're also potentially giving your opponent an opportunity, an opening to attack you.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Special Affairs Special Affairs Division, the actual antagonist from the deck here, is also kind of interesting. In that this can deal aggravated damage, and most of the time when your vampires are defeated, they go into a state called torpor, and they slowly regenerate. But aggravated damage can just remove them from the game, and so it's interesting to me that the city deck also introduces these antagonists that can, essentially remove your vampires from the game.
Yeah, they're like must answer threats. Like don't ignore them and just kind of hope for the best. Like they are going to have to be dealt with.
And I wonder too if that will affect deal making.
Ooh, yeah, I could see that. Like having to work together to beat stuff like the Special Affairs Division.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there's a bunch of mortals in the city deck as well. I think Toreador is a faction that is going to pay more attention to those. Because Toreador's agenda, they get points for attaching retainers. So that's something to keep in mind. There might be, I mean, I briefly skimmed through a couple of decks and that was seemed like it was one for them. There might be other, I'm sure there are other factions that want retainers as well, but.
Yeah. I mean, and you could definitely, because your havens and your agendas could be used by any faction, so.
Yes.
You can mix and match those. But yeah, out of the starter decks, the Toreador agenda and their haven both do things for you when you attach a citizen retainer.
So that's, I mean, I think that's the interesting parts of the city deck from a high level. I think Prince of the City is probably also a card that we should actually talk about.
Yes, which, good call.
Which is in the city deck, but is very important for gameplay.
Yeah, yeah, that's it's a title, so it goes on a character, and it is there's a lot of benefit here, it looks like, right? Plus two influence, which is what you use to vote on, you know, passing different things in the game. And at the start of your turn, you gain a crud. What's the, you literally just said it, the gold like
agenda
resource.
Prestige.
Yeah. Prestige. You gain a prestige and an agenda point. So it seems like it does a lot, but from what I could tell from the rules, it is also like hotly contested. Anybody, yeah, trying to claim it. So I wonder how often people can actually claim it
and hold on to it.
Yeah. Yeah,
it feels very much like being in Tokyo.
Oh, from King of Tokyo?
Yeah,
the
yeah.
Board game?
King of, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then also that the changing your secrecy to zero, secrecy is also a way that you can defend your vampires. And putting your secrecy at zero means anybody can attack them whenever, wherever they are.
Yeah, yeah. So a little disconnected from other things, but we might as well mention it now. To be attacked, the attacker has to have more intel than the target's secrecy, right?
I think it has to be equal.
Equal or more? Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
So they're kind of two keywords that kind of play off of each other like that. And I think most folks can pick up that connection from a like thematic sense pretty quickly.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. So if you're king, there's no hiding. Everyone knows who you are.
Speaking of kings, do you want to go move into starting to talk about factions?
Yeah, we could mention the factions here.
Because there's a couple of things that, I mean, the game itself reads very like the factions do a lot of what the theme wants them to do.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems very theme heavy.
I mean, and I'm okay with that, right? I am definitely a Shaga player when we talk Thrones stuff, but like it's the theme that draws me to things. And I, you know, that's what got me into Thrones, right? Were the books. And I have to admit, I do not have a strong connection to the world of darkness where the vampire game takes place. No, I don't know a lot about it. It's never really hooked me. So I have to, I guess, kind of hope that the gameplay is just very evocative and immersive.
If looking at these character cards as anything, there's a lot to do.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot of little icons on them with numbers, so
lots of icons.
There's probably gameplay there.
There's probably. So you mentioned about them having different strengths and such. So should we hit on what the four factions are that we got in the do I call this a core set? Is that what
on the box it says core set.
It does. Okay, good. So we get four here. So let's maybe say a little bit about what we know about them, maybe in alphabetical order, because I'm sure the two of us have them sitting here in different places.
Yep.
So, Bruja, right? Or I always think of having a Brujaha or a brute or something. They're the like physical, beefy in your face type of faction, right?
Yeah, they're like Gangs of New York if it was Interview with a Vampire.
Okay, yeah. Interview with a Gang?
Yeah.
Vampires of New York?
Yeah, I'm sure people who are like... anyone who's listening to this who actually knows this World of Darkness is going to be super cringing.
they're going to hate it. In our defense, we were hoping to have someone else on with us who is a like expert in the flavor of this world, but his copy of the core set had not arrived yet, so he wanted to hold off till he actually had cards and stuff. So maybe we will bring our mystery guest on in the future.
Hopefully. I sure hope so. Because I'm sure that in a game that's heavy about theme, it would help to have somebody who is well-versed in it.
Yeah, exactly.
The Bruja seem like they're very physical. Like, I'm going to punch you kind of maybe going for that knockout victory.
Yeah, that's the impression that I've gathered from them. I don't know if I have a lot more top level to say about them, unless we're digging into cards, or are we hitting each of the factions real high like that? Or did you want to mention cards?
I mean, at this point, I think it's probably best if we just hit high level themes and interactions, and we can get into actual cards maybe when we play.
Sure.
I think it's tough to say at this point, you know, if reading the leader, the suggested leader for the pre-constructed deck, you know, it's hard to say at this point whether or not during an attack paying one blood to draw a card is worthwhile.
I don't know. I've always been told that draw equals win. So yes.
Fair enough. I've been on the receiving end of draw equals win many times.
Exactly. Oh man. So okay, what's unless you had anything else about these guys, what's the next faction?
I have Malkavian next.
Sounds good. I was going to trade off and let you go.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Sorry. I didn't make that clear, but I was attempting to.
So the Malkavians, I feel, are like conspiracy theorists. They play a lot of schemes and conspiracies, which conspiracies play similar to agendas in Netrunner, or things that the corp puts out and then advances over time. So they'll put a card out face down and then put currency on top of it. And once you have so many currency on it, you flip it over and it has an effect. So Malkavian seems like they're playing a longer game, maybe more controlling. And they want to flip cards over to your detriment or to your opponent's detriment.
Yeah, and they're interesting. They're supposed to be like, you know, prophets and madmen, I think I'd seen written somewhere, which is, you know, a cool theme. But I'm really intrigued by this whole conspiracy business that you just brought up, because that is something fairly unique to this game that, like I said earlier, connects to this whole multiplayer focus and like theme in their design that we would hit on more. So let's talk about what the heck those conspiracies like are. Yeah. I mean, they're not just like face down cards, right? They're a way to force some table interaction.
Yeah. So here's like, I'll read, destroy the plans. is an action conspiracy. So you, this is going to be one of your two actions for the turn, would be to play this face down. So you play this card face down and place one prestige on it. If this card has three or more prestige on it, you may resolve it during your turn. Target foe who did not contribute discards three cards. So conspiracies go onto the board, and then any player can put a prestige on them to advance them. And there are detriments if you don't contribute. I haven't read all of them, but it seems like that's the consensus here, is if you don't contribute to a conspiracy, you're in for a bad time.
Right. But also, am I remembering correctly? I really hope I am, that if you're the person who played the conspiracy, you can choose to show it to any number of players at the table, right?
Oh, I'm not well versed enough in that.
I believe so. Let me flip to the conspiracies here.
Yeah, you are 100% right. At any time during the game, and as many times as you wish, you may reveal this card to foes of your choosing and invite them to join.
Yeah. So, and it's only those that it has been revealed to that can put tokens on it. So you do have to show people. You have to tell them what they're getting out of the conspiracy for joining up with you before you convince them to invest. I feel like I'm starting a like a pyramid scheme with these things. But I think that's so fascinating for what that does to a multiplayer game and kind of that table talking sort of leverage. And it kind of like codifies it in a like, hey man, like I really need you to back me on this and we can do something good, you know, and trying to really give mechanical heft to these sort of, hey, we need to work together to stop, you know, Joe Blow to the left of us, type of thing. I think it's fascinating. And the choice of who you do show it to and who you do not show it to, like not just whether they're going to be hit by it or not, but also what that says about your allegiances and who you trust and don't trust. Like, I think the conspiracies out of everything here in the rules are maybe the most intriguing to me out of this whole game.
They're cool. I think it's also worth at this time talking about a rule that is interesting, but is very wildly different from, Melee, and you know, if we're going to approach this as Thrones players, so in the rule book, it outlines that if you make a promise during your wheeling and dealing, you are obligated to keep that promise. And that to me is very, I mean, it's probably a conversation piece, right? Because there are both good and bad things to it. I think that it's going to be difficult to make that rule straight. What am I trying to say? I think there's going to be a lot of deals, a lot of lawyering when you're making deals.
Yeah.
So that you don't find yourself bound by what you promised, which is maybe a negative thing. I think that generally that just adds more time when you're not playing the game.
Yeah.
Or adds more feels bad moments.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. Yeah. It's going to lead to some real, or potentially lead to some real kind of wheedling sort of deals. Like, I'll do X for Y unless A, B, and C, and maybe D or E. But I also kind of wonder if it won't scare people out of making deals and just like reduce the total number of actual deals that get made.
Sure. And just so it comes down to like where either I have to make this deal or we all lose, or I don't care if I make this deal because I'm already going to win.
Yeah, maybe. And I wonder if maybe some of it is that if reducing the number of table talk deals that are made is maybe a feature that they are planning on, and that having things like conspiracies and schemes, which I'm sure we will also talk about in a bit, in the game as an actual mechanical system is kind of an attempt to move some of that emphasis into things that can be codified and tracked more easily rather than more nebulous table talky type of things.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. It's definitely a design choice, right? Like, it's definitely in the rule book and they thought about putting it there.
Oh, right. Totally.
It's just a matter of, again, I probably want to play a couple of games before I make a real educated guess on whether or not that's a good rule. But as a former melee player, I'm kind of hesitant on it because I know that there are a lot of turns where, you know, you make a promise and part of the whole Thrones element is backstabbing to gain power that you hope to leverage into winning. Mm-hmm. The classic example I have of that is when we were at a melee table together once, Will, and you promised not to make challenges against me for the rest of the game. I took that deal, and then you won. Well, you were right. You didn't make challenges against me. So it's interesting to see that here. We'll just have to see how it plays out.
I mean, people are always going to, there will always be people that have some difficulty with those type of deals. There we go. That's the way I'm gonna phrase it. Right? Like, some people have the type of mindset that plays well with melee, and some people that don't.
Yeah.
And some people do take it very personally, or have some real desire to have control at all times and don't handle things well when there are aspects and other players that they can't control and that type of thing. You know, I don't necessarily want to knock those type of players as much as I've seen those type of players knock melee and my type of players over the years in Thrones. I just think it's good for people to acknowledge which type of person they are. And there just are some that are not like geared mentally for one style or the other.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, we all have our own different wirings and what makes sense and what doesn't. So anyway, on topic of Malkavians, so I think the conspiracy aspect of them is probably one of the more interesting points of the entire game, like you said. But then they also have tricks that can force people to contribute to a conspiracy and then gets around the rule of not targeting them. So there's some tricks in here. I don't know if prophets or seers really comes out, though I do remember reading that.
Yeah.
Definitely seems like they're tricky, though.
And some of that, I'm sure, is just that, like, this is only the core set, so yeah,
right.
Some of the different themes will get expanded on more as we go.
All right, so I think that's all that I have for Malkavian at this point.
Yeah. I think I'm good there, too. Am I on to the next one?
You are.
All right. Next up, Toreador. This is one of the two that has kind of caught my interest so far. They're kind of the, I don't know, rock stars, movie stars, artists and whatever of the vampire world, the extra like social pretty ones, so to speak. And at least as far as their starter deck goes, they're geared a lot around, retainers. So they seem to do a lot with, interacting with humans in one way or another. But I think, don't they also do a decent bit of scheming as well?
They do. And schemes are different than conspiracies. So this is maybe the other interesting aspect of the game.
Right.
Which is where we talk about influence.
Mm-hmm.
So at the beginning of the game, the only vampire that has influence will be your leaders. And then other cards may grant them influence. So when you play a scheme, like one here I'm reading is Free Money. It's an action scheme, an influence conflict. Should each player gain 3 prestige? Now, sometimes it's should I gain agenda points or should I gain prestige? And then the whole table votes yes or no using influence.
And that's all it's used for in the game. It's just votes for schemes, right?
Yes, that's as far as I can tell.
Okay.
And then you can also exchange prestige for +1 influence at any time. So if you need to essentially win one of these schemes, but you know that the table is against you, you can put up prestige to make sure that you get your way.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes into play. So essentially there's two parts of voting for a scheme. There's the public voting where you announce starting with the one who's doing the scheme, which vampires you're going to commit, which influence you're going to commit. That's public knowledge. And then you actually end up going into bidding, where then you have a secret amount of influence that you're adding after the public influence has been revealed. So it's sort of like Trace in Netrunner, or reminiscent of Trace, which like it's interesting to me that this relies so heavily on that when I know Nisei has recently just taken Trace out of the game of Netrunner.
Wait, what? They did?
Yeah, they took it out entirely. And they explained that it always ended up being that it's either do you have more money than me? If so, do this.
Wow.
So, I mean, that might be more impactful in a strictly two-player asymmetrical game. But that was oftentimes my experience with it, right? Like, it's always the corp tries to trace the runner. And can you get the runner to... You either bankrupt the runner or... Yeah, it's just not super fun. So it's interesting to me to see how this will play out too. But I think it's different when you have, especially with a multiplayer focus. Though I think in that two-player game, the city deck is not contributing any influence. So this is one of those where this seems like a multiplayer rule that feels weird when put into a two-player game.
Yeah, I guess it is. It's just not as interactive, I guess. Like you said, it's just, do you have more influence? But I guess to some extent, like any sort of, I don't know, event card, action card, spell type of thing, right? A lot of times boils down to just, do you have X resources? Whatever that is, whether that's red mana or gold or whatever, mm-hmm. to like play this card. Is that really practically that much different than just saying, do you have X influence, where X happens to be, you know, whatever your opponent's is +1?
Yeah, I generally think that this kind of, I mean, I think you're right. There are these examples of that type of mechanic in a lot of different games. I just generally think it's lazy.
Okay.
So that's my hot take.
I mean, it's certainly more interesting in multiplayer. I will definitely say that, where, you know, the conspiracies, of course, were the more secretive side of this, while schemes are public knowledge. Everybody knows and, you know, can bicker about who does what. Mm-hmm. Having both is fascinating. I mean, that's not something that really existed in Thrones. You made your choices and you just kind of did your thing. I mean, and yes, you might try to convince other people to make choices or whatever, but like, there weren't inherently cards that said, okay, right now the whole table, you know, bickers over whether Valor goes off or whatever.
Yeah, wild. I mean, I also don't think you could actually show other players cards from your hand in Thrones without a reason, right? So, like, that's the conspiracy part of this is also interesting, where you decide who sees it and then invite particular people to participate. And maybe that could even be a deal thing, too. Like, I'll show you my conspiracy and let you participate, so you won't have this negative.
Oh, totally.
It's, yeah. Then the scheme thing. Yeah, I think the scheme things are interesting in multiplayer, and I just think they're probably not super interesting in single player. I mean, I don't think that they're going to be bad. I think they'll still be worth playing and they'll still be good. I just don't know that it's going to be super as interesting.
Yeah, it'll be much more straightforward. And there may be less of them that are practically playable in one-on-one as well, right? The like payoff may just not be worth it versus just, you know, putting your card slots into something else, attacks or something.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
You did give me another thought though about schemes and conspiracies, where and the whole like public and private nature of it, where you may even be able to use schemes as kind of a like fishing to see who backs you publicly on a scheme, to see whether they are like worthwhile to let them into your conspiracy, because they'll hopefully back you there. I don't know. There's just like a lot of table play layers to these cards.
Yeah, that's interesting. I have not put that much level of thought into how to wheel and deal things yet.
Whoops. My bad.
So I know now when I play with you that to watch out for how people are reacting to schemes.
Crap. I'm giving away all my tips to Sam already.
Yeah. In this game that neither of us have played.
Yeah, exactly. There's going to be people listening to this on down the line with, you know, dozens of games under their belts are going to be like, what were these guys smoking?
Oh, yeah. But that's the fun part, because next time around, we're going to come in with games under our belt and we're going to be like, what were we smoking?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Anything else to hit in general on Toreador, or are we on to you hitting Ventru?
Yeah, let's go. I think we can move on to Ventru. I think that's the interesting parts of Toreador, I think, are the schemes. So.
Okay.
And then the Ventru are more royalty focused, right? These are the classic Stoker, like, vampires are superior. They're nobles. They come from wealth. They're interested in ruling and being on top.
Yeah.
They want the others to pledge fealty, essentially, and know their place. And yeah,
exactly. The divine right of vampires.
And in the way that that's reflected in this is actually through attachments. So they attach cards called titles to their vampires and want to utilize different essentially extra actions that are not the base actions, but they're actions on these titles. So it seems sort of, I mean, it seems to me kind of Voltron-y, but not maybe on one character. But you want to get a lot of these attachments out to different vampires to have different, and then and these titles, a lot of them grant influence, or need influence. So I think money is going to be a focus for the venture as well. Probably getting influence by spending prestige. So it's like there's a couple of cards here that also allow them to gain gain more prestige than the initial 20 that you start with. The venture also have schemes in the pre-constructed deck.
And I think there's a couple of conspiracies when I flipped through as well.
And I'm not seeing as many. Well, I guess that's not true. But one of the things I think is interesting about combat in this game are attack and reaction cards, attack and defense cards, rather. Mm-hmm. And so some factions have are more combat focused. I think these are. I think the venture are also maybe combat focused. But a lot of cards in this game are more played in combat than they are as like adding to your board. They're modifiers for how combat goes, which is also very similar to how the Naruto CCG combat went. So I'm now that I've looked him up and realized that like this guy designed the game that came after the CCG for that, like. I don't know. I wonder if I'm just seeing a lot of things that are looking familiar here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, is there, well, okay. I guess I do maybe have one thought about Ventru in general, and then maybe we could go ahead and move to talking about the kind of action phase as a whole and the various actions,
sure.
Which you, yeah, kind sorry, of hitting general. At. And no, that's okay. And 'cause that'll let us get into the different attacks and all of that stuff. So my last thought on Ventru, you kind of mentioned the Voltron thing, you know, attachments and titles and all. And I think you're kind of right about it needing to be like wider spread, because a lot of these titles are unique, right? And mm-hmm. unique in regards to like draw deck library cards, not vampires, because vampires are global unique, mm-hmm. but unique on your attachments just means one per character, right? Or is it global unique as well? Like only one like person ever can have Herald. No, yeah, Herald is unique. Like Herald out at a time.
I don't think that my reading of the rules showed that they were global uniques, except for Prince of the City, which comes from.
Yeah. That's what I thought. And something like Primogen says specifically that it's one per player. So that's like, you know, Thrones unique. Because it would feel weird to me if it was like global unique for the deck to like the starter deck, even to have three Heralds in it, you know?
Right.
So I took it as one per character. So it's maybe kind of a almost hoardy Voltron idea.
Well, so the thing is, once a vampire with a title is in Torpor, then you can play that title out on another vampire. And then the one that's attached already is burned is discarded.
Okay.
So it's kind of, it actually might be global, but then the way to get around that is if you put them in if you put that title character in Torpor and then play your own, then that title drops off the vampire that had been previously defeated.
Oh, okay.
So it's an incentive to fight your opponent's vampires.
Yeah.
That will be something we'll have to come back to and see if that is global or not, because that will especially in mirror matches, which mirror matches are already seeming going to be difficult.
Yeah, with the vampires being global unique, like we said, right, that is going to muck with some things. I would really hate, especially a, you know, like a competitive event or something,
yeah,
to roll up with my 7-card crypt and like discover that my opponent and I are both playing like 5 of the same vampires.
Well, not only 5 of the same vampires, but the same leader.
Yeah, the same leader in particular. Somebody gets screwed if you have kind of built your deck around starting with a particular vampire. Yep. You could run into problems.
Yeah.
So, I mean, strategy-wise, that means you're always going to have a backup in mind.
Right.
It could get real awkward real fast if there's a lot of overlap.
Yes. And, yeah, I think that's probably my biggest criticism right now is the global uniqueness of vampires. Just because, like, we're given 7 vampires in these starter decks. I guess it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see how many new vampires the Crypt Pack has. Though I guess this is also going to be one of those where you're not limited to one faction when you're building your crypt. So,
right. You can mix and match however you want.
Right.
So even really saying these are factions, I do admit, is kind of disingenuous because there's almost nothing in the card game that actually enforces any sort of faction like loyalty or construction.
There are some draw deck cards that have the title of like a clan on them, in which case you'll need, or so they'll have the symbol, the clan symbol in the top right corner. So like for Ventru, right, it's a sword and scepter, right? And so if you are going to try and play a card with that on it, you need to be able to spot a vampire from that clan to use like the Star Wars Destiny terminology, right, where like you need to have one of those in play before you can use that card. So it's going to affect what cards you put in your draw deck, I guess, is really how the faction comes into play. But there's nothing to say that you can't play all 4 factions in your crypt and draw deck.
Yeah, it's all just kind of the balance of like how you draw them.
Right. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I mean, you'd probably be giving up some power, but you could go entirely factionless if you wanted.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's necessarily smart. Because it seems like a lot of these, I mean, a lot of the faction-specific cards are doing things that faction wants to do, which, at least from a high-level perspective.
Right.
Like Ventru wanting to use a lot of influence. One of the Ventru cards is long-term investment, and this is something that's going to essentially let you gain more prestige, and so that will fund your influence buying. So
some influence.
It seems like it's tied. These cards are tied very heavily to theme, which is good. I suppose it's similar to loyal and non-loyal.
Yeah, that's fair. It's a close idea to that.
Yeah, adjacent, maybe.
Yeah. Okay. Well, shall we bring it back around to the various actions? Because I know you were wanting to talk about attacks.
Yeah, I think that would be good. Just to kind of give a general idea of these cards and how attacks do play in this game. Like a lot of your draw deck cards are cards you're going to play face down after you declare an attack, or once you declare a defender, or rather once your vampire has been declared as a defender. And it seems like this is going to add some tension. Because, like, so strictly speaking, if you pit two vampires against each other, they're going to compare their base stats. And if you have one physical and I have zero physical, I'm going to take one damage. If you're launching a physical attack. But these attack and defense cards can modify that number or that stat a little bit. So it seems like a lot of the combat is going to be oriented on who has cards in their hand to play. So I guess that's where draw equals win, right?
Right, right. Draw does equal win. And so one of the actions then is to draw a card. And that's the only inherent draw, right? There's not one at the start of the turn. Correct. For you. So... And honestly, the action phase here, and particularly
that's false. There, you do draw two cards at the end of your turn.
Oh yeah, at the end. Okay.
Yep.
I did miss that because I'm so used to it being at the start most of the
time. Yeah, I thought that was odd too. But you draw to end your turn. You draw two, and you can draw two vampires, or you can draw two from the draw deck, or one from each. Or you can mix and match as you go.
Yeah. So that type of thing, at least action-wise and being able to just click to draw a card, so to speak, really, really gives me that Netrunner type of vibe. Like, you have the explicit resources of, you know, influence and the like, but you also have an like implicit resource that people don't always necessarily think of that way, which is your, you know, actions, action point, your two actions, whatever I want to really call that concept. You have two of them. How do you want to spend them?
And I think in that regard, turns are going to go fast because you only get two actions, but you have a lot of options. And so, well, it could either go fast or slow. I guess I've had plenty of Netrunner games that went very long, even though you only have three actions.
Yeah, I mean, I've had plenty of Netrunner games where I had to spend three turns sitting there where my entire turn was, you know, click for a cred, click for a cred, click for a cred, your turn.
Yeah.
Just over and over.
Now, you're always supposed to run on the last click.
Well, if you'll note that I only took three actions, that means I was poor.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. So
I think that's more likely to happen on the corp side, but that's an entirely different thing. maybe we'll talk Netrunner on another show.
I think that the limiting of how many actions you get is how this mostly comes across as more of a board game than like a straight card game. Okay. Cause I think, you know, like just like a lot of board games you get, you know, like in a lot of Euro games or whatever, you'll get two actions, and so you want to find the action economy for that particular game, and how you build your engine to provide that economy is, you know, maybe how like the bulk of that game. And I think, you know, reading through cards, there are a lot of things where it's like, when this happens, do this, and like those do this parts are actions or are the results of taking an action. So it's like when you defeat a foe, draw a card. So it's like you're getting an extra action by doing a thing. If that wasn't a very confusing way of saying that.
That's all right. What about some of these other actions then? I guess we were just talking about attacks and having to kind of inject that uncertainty in by playing attack and reaction cards, which is, you know, what led us to the importance of draw. But what about the attacks themselves? I find it fascinating. We've got another Thrones nod here. Then we've got those three icons hanging out on the left side of the card for what is it? Physical, social, and mental, right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
which are essentially the three different attacks. There's a like point fifth attack, but I'll get to that in a sec and why I dislike that.
Yeah. I'm gonna not find it here. It's interesting. I think you're right that this is reminiscent of Thrones, where you see three icons, and each character can make this attack, based on whether or not they have the stat.
And they kind of have like an individual strength for each one. You have to have some kind of something in that stat to attack, right?
Yep.
Though you could get that from the card you played face down, I think. But they all have the same effect, so to speak. Well, basically meaning whatever your attack card is. They don't have inherent differences between a physical and a mental attack like right. Thrones does between military and power, right?
And the end result, you're always going to be reducing, you're going to be hoping to do damage to reduce that particular vampire's blood to zero. And yeah. Blood is their health points.
And it's also conveniently the amount you purchase them for.
Yes.
Their cost.
Yeah, I think from a design standpoint, using the prestige tokens and then flipping them over to become blood tokens, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I like that. I do wish that is one weird thing that I found about the manual when I was going, because the game says, like, it's got the parts breakdown on the inside cover there.
Yeah.
And it mentions that there are 80 blood/prestige tokens, right? They're double-sided and whatever.
Yeah.
And then there's also some comments in here about how the prestige tokens are color-coded so that, you know, when you're playing, you have all the ones for your color, and, you know, if you run out of those, you're out, and that sort of thing. And like you mentioned earlier about putting prestige on like a conspiracy, that helps you tell who has voted for it and that sort of thing. But it doesn't tell you how many, like, it tells you how many there are total, but not how many there are for each color. I mean, I assume it's an even split, like 20 yeah. each, but it just seems weird to me to not specifically say you start the game with 20 prestige at any point.
Well, it says it right here, and each player chooses a different color and grabs 20 value worth of prestige tokens in that color.
Oh, where was that? Maybe I skimmed and
literally page and 3.
Went past that line.
Top right, numerical 3.
Oh, there we go. And it's even bolded. I must have just been reading too quickly and skimmed past that.
Yeah. So there are 20 tokens for each color, but some are 3s and some are 1s. So
yeah. Okay.
So that's going to be how that will work.
Well, that's my bad. I'll jump ship then, since we were recently talking about attacks, and I will talk about one thing about attacks that bugs me here is that there's 3 stats printed on characters here, right?
Yep.
And associated attacks with that. But there's a 4th type of attack that can only be made if you have a card that has the ranged attack on it.
It's because still no technically character treated as a physical attack.
Where does it say that?
Well, if you read the rule book, Will.
I mean, I didn't see that it calls it that. I saw that it says range damage reduced by the target's physical attribute, but I didn't see where it said it counts as a physical attack.
Oh, well, you're right. Maybe this is my bad. That is very interesting that they say that there are 3 types of attacks, and yet there's this weird 4th one hanging out there.
Yeah, this fourth one that, like, you can't make on its own, but, like, it doesn't have its own thing because the characters don't have it, so that it has to reference a different one that the characters do have. And, like, it just feels really tacked on, like, last minute to me. I was talking to a friend of the show, Tommy, who said it didn't bug him and that it reminded him of things like dueling in L5R. But... like, that just made me want it, like, fully separate. Like, sure, whatever, if you want to make it, you know, like dueling or something. But, like, don't claim that it's an attack. Like, yeah, oh, yeah, it's just like all the other attacks. Except it's, like, way different from all the attacks. But really, it's an attack. Just, like, make it its own separate thing. It feels very strange.
Well... I don't know that that's necessarily how it should work, though, because there are definitely cards that will defend against ranged attacks very much like other attacks. So I think it uses the same framework. It should just be maybe more straightforward. And maybe that attack type is ranged, and so you're going to announce a ranged attack, but you know it's not printed on cards yet. I mean, maybe that's a design space option.
Maybe.
But it doesn't seem that way, since, like, if a character doesn't have a stat line in that icon, it's literally printed as zero.
Right.
Which also was interesting to me, where it's like, if it was, I don't know, maybe this is just the Thrones player in me that's looking at this card and saying, if it has zero physical and zero social, why would you have those icons there? But that might just be more.
I guess it sidesteps the potential rules issue of ever having to refer to something as null. Mm-hmm. Like, it's never non-existent. It's just that the value is zero.
Sure.
Which I do recall things like null causing some issues in Thrones over the years.
And then I also think it's interesting that the vampire's character cards have these little diamonds underneath the stat lines and in the text box.
Yeah.
And those are essentially traits.
Traits or...
they're called disciplines, right?
They're disciplines here. I was trying to remember what they were in first edition of Thrones. Crests.
Crests.
Yeah. First edition.
So I thought that was interesting too. And, like, that's... I don't know. I guess I would rather just have the word printed out. Because it's going to be a lot of iconography for me to remember.
Yeah, they're so icon heavy. I mean, the cards, I hate to say, do look kind of cluttered to me. And that's even aside from the fact that, like, you know, I'm looking down the side of somebody like, say, the Toreador, oof, I'm going to butcher her name, Li Zhu Chen. Maybe? Yeah. I don't know. I'm butchering it.
I'm not going to judge yet. I don't know how to say that name.
I apologize to everyone who does know how to pronounce that properly. But, like, looking down her left side, like, between her, whatever, her blood potency or whatever that's called, which is her cost, then all the stats running down the side, then all the disciplines, like, that whole edge is totally full of seven total icons. And that's not even all of the available disciplines.
Right.
Judging by that layout, I doubt they will ever give a vampire more than three disciplines. But it just means, like, there are more icons to remember than just those seven. There's, how many disciplines are there? They're mentioned somewhere here in the rule book. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So there's 11 of those symbols to keep track of.
It just seems like a lot. Like I said, I just wish it had been written out. Kind of like you say here, I think it's going to be very difficult if they ever wanted to make a vampire with more than three disciplines. I don't know. That's maybe nitpicky about, you know, card layout and in-game design, but I'm sure it will be fine. But yeah,
hopefully it will be
like a lot to remember. And in general, I think the less, the fewer opportunities for me to lose a game because I don't remember what a symbol does, or, you know, if I just glance at it and I'm not sure what that means, or I just think, oh, this means this, or, you know, for instance, the blank diamond versus a diamond with two dashes, three dashes.
Like, you know,
it's just going to be one of those where I'm going to confuse them and I'm going to feel bad about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Or a lightning bolt versus a star, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever it might be. There's, I mean, this is not brand new to Rivals.
No.
The older vampire card game, The Eternal Struggle, did it as well. But in board and card game design over the last few years, I've noticed there's been a strong push to remove text and rely heavily on iconography. I mean, I've got stuff sitting over here like, Cthulhu Wars or something. I can't recall the name of it. It's one of the little, like two player, kind of drafting games, like deck builder, and it is entirely icon based. Like, there's no texts on those card abilities, and that honestly is harder for me to grok and remember, like from card to card, play to play, than just writing everything out. I understand they're trying to make it more portable to other languages than English. But there's gotta be other speakers of those languages in the same boat as me that like have a harder time with just a giant blob of icons than text.
At least it's not color based.
That's true. That's true.
I would have a very hard time with that.
Are you colorblind or partially colorblind?
Just mildly, but not.
Some are
more difficult, but reds and oranges both look the same to me, unless they're separate.
Oh, gotcha.
But yeah. So I think that's from a high level perspective. I think we've hit kind of a lot of what my thoughts were. I'm excited to play. I think, you know, despite spending a few minutes there at the end just kind of talking about these are things I don't like about it, I do think it looks exciting to try.
Yeah, yeah. We wouldn't be bothering to talk about it here on the show if we were not excited. Yeah. I mean, honestly, even just flipping through these now while we've been talking, I'm already like, okay, I want to get, you know, a couple starter games out of the way to figure out what I'm doing. And then I want to build my own deck because I can start seeing like stuff that I'm like, oh, okay, maybe that's how I want to play. But I probably ought to figure out if that's any good.
One thing I have noticed throughout this is that if you want to build multiple decks, you might want to pick up a second core.
It's worth pointing out that you only need to do that for the multiple decks because there's a full play set of everything in one box.
Yes. It's just that there are some card, like neutral cards, where there's like maybe two copies in the Malkavian deck and then the other two copies are in the Venture deck. So if you wanted to run a full playset, or is it three? I'm not sure if it's three or four. But if you wanted to run a full stock in a deck, in two decks, you would need a second core set for that.
Yeah. But also then at that point, I mean, if you're not all in on kind of particular strategies, you could probably build like more than just two decks at a pretty high level at that point.
Yeah, I agree with that. I have not even opened this crypt pack, so I'm excited for us to come back in a few weeks and hopefully talk about some of the cards in here and maybe reflect on the things that we were wildly wrong about.
Yeah. I have not cracked the crypt pack either, but I'm very intrigued because I've at least sort of gathered through comments, I think maybe even in the rule book, that there are things like additional agendas and havens in there, which already seem like they're kind of, both of those things are kind of like what a Thrones player would think of as an agenda.
Yeah.
So you sort of have two Thrones style agendas in the game, and you can mix and match those. And several of them already look very intriguing to me just out of these little starter decks. So if there are like a couple more here in the Crypt Pack with even like weirder, more interesting abilities, like I'm kind of dying to know what that is.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's interesting the parallels between the agendas and in this game and the agendas in Thrones. And like you say, how they're essentially of two parts. And how you're where you decide to make your safe house or your haven rather, can play a big part. Which again, kind of this is a little bit back to what we were talking about before. But these global uniques again, this is where it's like if I build my deck around the Toreador vampire, Belaforte, and this agenda and this haven, and all of a sudden I'm facing off against somebody else who has that vampire as their leader. I don't know. That just seems like it's going to be difficult.
Hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I'm very curious to see how that aspect shakes out.
Yeah. There are a lot of pieces here. There are a lot of cards, a lot of moving pieces to the game. But I think once it starts and once it gets rolling, it should move fairly quick. And then I really like this city deck as the board playing.
Yeah, yeah, I'm very intrigued by that and look forward to seeing what they do with it in the future, because I can't imagine they don't release either more city decks, to change up organized play in future years, do a new one each year or something, kind of like the Cthulhu LCG used to do for their stories each year, or for them to drop some kind of big, crazy, like solo or co-op challenge type of thing.
Right. Yeah, that's... I think the city deck, being able to customize a city deck, is going to have to be. I mean, it's got to be just a matter of time, right? Like there are only so many cards in there that once you play through them, even if you're burning seven at the beginning of each game, you're going to figure out which cards you want to see and how to manipulate that pretty quickly. So
right. And if the city deck is supposed to be kind of a sort of a threat to you and your plans in kind of an unpredictable way, like it's the sort of thing that as this game expands and the player card pool gets bigger, they will be able to mitigate the city deck more. So it's going to have to change in some way to keep up with the expansion and like power creep of the player decks.
Right. Yeah. Overall, I'm excited.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is good. Honestly, when we kind of pared the scope of the podcast down for this week, realizing we did not have the time to, or really probably interesting things to say about a total fresh read of literally every card in the box.
Yeah.
I think there was still a lot of stuff to chew over here. So. Yeah, I'm excited.
Yeah, and I guess with that, I think that probably puts us in a 2-hour danger zone.
I think it does. We'll be right back.